From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Fallout from last week's deadly winter storm in Texas continues today. Five board members of the state's power grid operators say they will resign. And now Texas officials say they have opened a criminal investigation after that storm left dozens of people dead and caused millions of homes and businesses to lose power for days on end. We're going to take a deeper look at that now. Travis County District Attorney Jose Garza is leading the new investigation, and he joins us now. Mr. Garza, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And let's start with why. Why are you opening this investigation?
Well, we have to start with the fact that what happened last week in Texas was horrifying. Far too many people lost their lives. Homes were lost. And it's going to take weeks, months, and in some cases years for people in Texas to be made whole again. And there are some families across our state who will never be made whole. We have a responsibility to review any action or inaction that led to the death and to the suffering that people experienced. And we have a responsibility to hold powerful actors accountable if there is evidence of criminal wrongdoing.
And I guess the question is, what powerful actors are you talking about? I know there's only so much you can tell us in an investigation as it just gets started like this, but what people or entities will you be looking into?
Well, throughout the course of last week, first of all, I was incredibly grateful and moved, by the spirit of our community that came through, by firefighters, EMS, law enforcement, and just regular folks throughout our state who stepped up to make sure that our neighbors were safe. I'm so proud of everyone who took action. And I also watched in horror as last week unfolded. And me and my office, we are deeply concerned about action and inaction that may have led to this crisis. And so we will be reviewing any and all actions or inaction that may have led to this crisis.
Does that include potentially looking at the actions or inactions of elected officials or the power grid operators at ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas?
Well, we're going to do what we always do, which is we're going to review the facts and the evidence. And we're going to apply those facts and that evidence to the law, and we're going to follow the facts and evidence wherever they may lead.
Okay, I understand it is difficult for you to answer that question. I have to ask it, though. So clearly the grid was not prepared. That much is obvious. The power equipment was not weatherized. The electrical generation system went offline. Arguably, it is bad public policy, but how would it potentially cross the line into criminal activity?
Well, there are a number of, potential actions or inaction that may give rise to criminal culpability that may have been criminal in their nature, and they range a gamut of potential actions and inaction, and we're going to be looking at all of it.
All right. Well, as you well know, people died in their homes of hypothermia. They died of carbon monoxide poisoning because they had to light fires or barbecues inside their homes to stay warm. I want to listen to this here from Amanda Phillips, an Austin resident who tested positive, by the way, for COVID in the midst of all this. She spoke to the Austin American-Statesman newspaper.
Your house is where you should feel safe and warm and comfortable. And all of a sudden, it's this place where, you might die.
What's your message to Texans and to others who feared for their lives last week or who lost loved ones in this tragedy?
Well, as someone who lived through last week and saw in my community, in our neighborhood across central Texas and who has relatives across the state, I was horrified to see the lengths that people were forced to go, burying insulin in the snow, connecting medical equipment to car batteries, the steps that you described, And what I want people across our community to know is that we will not forget the horror that our community experienced, that we are going to take a close look at any action or inaction that led to that death, that led to that suffering. We will do everything we can to hold powerful actors whose action or inaction may have led to that suffering accountable.
Jose Garza, district attorney for Travis County, Texas, announcing an investigation into the failures behind that storm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Washington, on Capitol Hill, confirmation hearings are continuing for President Biden's cabinet picks. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us now with an update. Hello, Claudia.
Hi there.
So let's start with President Biden's choice to lead the Office of Management and Budget, Neera Tanden. This nomination is clearly in jeopardy. What happened, Claudia?
Yes, two committees, the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee and the Senate Budget Panel, were both due to take their next steps today to move Tanden's nomination forward. But both committees have postponed, and we don't know when and if they'll reschedule these hearings. The Senate Homeland Security Committee told me that I spoke to an aide for the panel and told me that those members need more time to consider the nomination, and they're going to work together to see what that potential best path forward is. I also spoke to an aide for the Senate Budget Committee. This is chaired by Senator Bernie Sanders. And they tell me that Sanders spoke to Tanden last night about the delay, but it's still not clear. They didn't give any specifics on why they're postponing this. We have already seen her support waning in recent days. For example, conservative moderate Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia said recently he would oppose this nomination. He cited her critical tweets about U.S. senators as one reason not to move forward. So she would need surprise GOP support to survive this nomination process, and so far she's not getting it. For example, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine and another GOP member, Mitt Romney of Utah, have both said they will vote against her. One wild card is Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. She has not said where she stands, but this postponement does not bode well for Tanden. That said, we haven't heard from the White House and whether they're ready to change gears. Just the opposite, actually. They're saying that they want to keep pushing on Tanden to see if that nomination will go through, because they believe that a White House official said today, for example, that she has broad spectrum of support ranging from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to the labor union.
Wow. Well, let me ask you about Deb Haaland, President Biden's pick for Interior Secretary. Quickly, she's speaking before senators today. What are you hearing there?
Yes, she's going into that second day of hearings before the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. She's taking on another wave of questions from members on the panel on everything from federal protections for the grizzly bear to water and mining concerns. If she's confirmed, she would be the first Native American cabinet member.
Yeah.
But we're not clear whether Republicans will support her. They have raised concerns about aggressive action on climate change. And so even though this is a historic nomination, they have raised concerns about the future of fossil fuels and whether there could be jobs threatened when it comes to oil and gas and what have you. Now, Haaland herself has been pretty consistent on saying that there will be a balance for the administration between the use of oil and gas and renewable energy sources like solar and wind. However, we know she's very progressive on energy and climate change, and this is exactly what Republicans are zeroing in on during their questioning.
Claudia, let me ask you quickly about the congressional hearings into the January 6th insurrection. A lot of blame to go around yesterday. Here's Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund in his opening remarks yesterday.
Based on the intelligence that we received, we plan for an increased level of violence at the Capitol and that some participants may be armed. But none of the intelligence we received predicted what actually occurred.
About a minute left here for us. Claudia, what did you hear from police and the other security officials? What did they say went wrong?
They all believe the insurrection was premeditated, that white supremacist groups played a key role, and as we just heard there, they blame intelligence failures for leaving the Capitol Police blindsided that day. And we also did see some contradictory accounts between these former security officials. For example, Sun himself said he had tried to get in touch with Paul Irving, this is the former House Sergeant at Arms, that day, just after 1 p.m., to call in the National Guard, but Irving said he never got the call. He said he got the request after around 2 p.m. or later that day. Of course, the National Guard did not show up for hours. And so this is one issue of many that senators and others are saying need to be looking into further, even if that includes pulling phone records or what have you. So this is just the beginning, and there's many more hearings to come.
So much more to come, indeed. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, really appreciate you taking the time today. Claudia, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It took 70 days, 3 hours, and 48 minutes for Jasmine Harrison to row across the Atlantic Ocean. And at 21 years old, she's the youngest woman to complete an ocean crossing alone. Her boat was 23 feet long, weighed about a ton, and included a small cabin and a bunker that she slept in. And on Saturday, she rowed it into English Harbor on the Caribbean island of Antigua, finishing the 3,000-mile journey that began in the Canary Islands off the northwest coast of Africa. Jasmine Harrison joins us now from Antigua. Jasmine, welcome and congratulations.
Hi, thank you.
How does it feel to have just finished this profound 70-day journey across the Atlantic?
It feels insane. It feels unreal and every different emotion you can imagine, from disappointment or sadness that I've actually finished because I actually loved it out there, to just overwhelmingness and everything. I can't describe it properly.
Okay, well, before we get into what the experience was actually like, why did you want to do this in the first place?
I didn't know why I wanted to do it. It just was something cool, and I knew that it would be what I wanted to do without knowing why. And my sort of body was like, you've just got to do it. And my mind was, it wouldn't let me move on with my life until I actually entered and then completed.
Did you have any experience rowing at all?
No, none at all. Literally, it sounds really daft, but actually finding out about the race and I entered it. And it was only months afterwards, it clicked with me. I went, hang on, rowing boats go backwards. Like, I didn't even think about it like that. That was sort of what kind of built it up and made it even better, is the fact that I would have to teach myself something from scratch, and it was a real project.
Wow, that's amazing. So why don't we talk about what it was like? Explain the experience of rowing across the Atlantic Ocean. How far did you go every day? How did you sleep? How did you navigate?
It depended on the day. Some days I went backwards because the weather was really bad. Other days I went completely like north or south and it was just wrong. The weather was a big factor. I navigated just because I had an app on my phone, and then on my iPad when my phone then broke. And it's quite easy to navigate. You literally are heading straight west. And some days I would literally go backwards, but then other days I would be able to get over 60 miles.
Wow. And speaking of the weather, I understand you capsized twice along the way. What happened?
So the first one I was rowing, it was really rough out. I was managing normally to sort of avoid the big waves and drop the oars and sort of brace myself and, you know. But then this rogue wave just caught me from the side and took me straight overboard and self-righted, and I got flung straight back on, landed on deck. And I was like, oh, wow, that happened. And that was fine. Didn't bother me. But then the second one, I was in my cabin, and that was only 2 days before I finished. That was a worse one. I went the full way around, whacked myself off the ceiling. I actually really injured myself as well. I remember smashing my head. So I had a lump on my head. Hurt my back, like my lower back, because I'd landed on something. But I also really damaged my elbow. And so I actually really struggled to row because I couldn't bend my arm past 90 degrees. So that wasn't fun. But at that point, I was kind of glad about the capsize because it made me want to actually then finish. I was ready to finish, ready to say goodbye to that ocean. It was just amazing.
Well, when you say that, I think, yeah. I mean, after 70 days at sea, you must have been eager to get home. You must have been eager to see other people. What was the isolation like out there in the open ocean?
The isolation, whilst you're there, it's sort of what you get used to. You know, you sort of, my brain anyway, it lessens something a lot just to make it more manageable and easier to deal with. But now I'm like, it's starting to dawn on me. I'm like, all right, 70 days is a long time. It really, really is.
No moments of panic for you?
There's plenty of moments of panic, especially being by yourself. And you overthink, or I overthink quite a lot about every different scenario that could happen. Sometimes I get scared, but you just have to set your mind straight again.
Did any animals keep you company?
Oh, yeah. I had loads of animals. I had lots of fish, lots of different kinds of fish as well. So I had some trigger fish. I had lots of Dorado. I had pilot fish. I had dolphins, different kinds of dolphins. I had whales. I even had a crab on my boat. I had a squid come on my boat. There's lots of birds as well. Yeah, just amazing. You're out there with nature and there's just so much. And there's so much I didn't see either. Whales even, they're so big, but they're the color of the sea. And if they don't rise, you don't see them.
So maybe it's a cliche, but a journey like that makes me think that it could shed some light on what it means to be alive and to be a human being on this planet. Do you think what you just did changed you?
Yeah, I think it really did. It has to have. Like, it really has to have. Nobody can see them amazing views, them amazing sunsets, being so surrounded by wonderful animals and just bodies and bodies of water for so long without it changing you. I think it's when I go back home and then I'm in normality, I guess, a little bit, that then I'll realize how I'm being changed.
No, I think that's absolutely fair. And now, though, in the meantime, you have the title of being the youngest woman to row solo across an ocean. Is that a distinction that matters to you?
Yeah, I have that title. And no, it doesn't. It doesn't matter to me. I wanted to do this just because I thought it was cool and it was something that was calling me and that I just wanted to do. But it doesn't matter your age of whether you want to do something or not, or how big or scary something is. If you're scared of something when you're 30, if you're scared of something when you're 3, it doesn't make any difference. That's you as a person. I just want everybody to feel you can do something if you feel ready for it. Don't rely on somebody else telling you that.
21-year-old Jasmine Harrison just completed a 3,000-mile, 70-day journey rowing by herself across the Atlantic Ocean. What a feat. Congratulations and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. No, it was really nice to speak to you.
The Philadelphia Orchestra is releasing its performance of a work by a Black woman composer who has all but been forgotten to history. Florence Price had one of her pieces performed in 1933 by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on the revival of Price's work almost 70 years after her death.
5 years ago, concert pianist Michelle Kahn was asked to look at a score by Florence Price, a name she had known only as a minor footnote in music history.
And at first, I was hesitant because I thought, well, you know, I've never heard of this piece. I hardly heard of her. So it might not be that great of a work.
Just after reading the music, having not even played it yet, she knew she was holding something extraordinary.
And I could not believe it. I was speechless. I said, why have I never heard of this?
The Philadelphia Orchestra has just released its new performance of Florence Price's Concerto in One Movement as a digital stream. It is Kahn's Philadelphia Orchestra debut. This music was written in 1934 and performed a few times around Chicago by women's orchestras of the time, but by World War II that stopped. When Price died in 1953, the score for the concerto was lost to history. Decades later, the score was reimagined based on existing fragments, but recently the entire original manuscript was rediscovered. The Philadelphia Orchestra is the first to perform the work as Price had intended in over 80 years.
She has so many different characters in her pieces. You can hear the 30s and such in her writing. You hear that American and African-American influence, dances and spirituals, but you hear that classical romantic influence very strongly.
This is the second piece by Price that the Philadelphia Orchestra is performing this season. The first, her Symphony No. 1, was played in November. Price was supposed to be the subject of a 3-day conference at Cornell University, organized by One Composer, an initiative to raise awareness of unsung, mostly African-American composers. But the coronavirus pandemic canceled that conference. Co-founder Stephen Spinelli said a performance by an orchestra of Philadelphia's stature should make the larger classical world take notice of this forgotten artist.
There is a responsibility in recording history to be complete, and we haven't been. So when students don't learn this music in their band rooms, in their chorus rooms, and in their textbooks, that really does erase them.
Florence Price did not go quietly into the night. For most of her life, she struggled to get noticed by the major orchestras of the time, writing personal letters to conductors pleading with them to consider her work. But Spinelli says her efforts never bore fruit.
Let's just be honest. There's her own proclaimed, she called them handicaps in her lifetime, of sex and race. And she was very vocal about how challenging her career was because of those two factors.
Michelle Kahn, the pianist, who is also Black, has taken up the struggle where Price left off. She has performed several of Price's works over the last few years. As she was about to perform with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Kahn stepped away from her piano and gave an impromptu speech about how important that moment was.
I stood up and I said how grateful I was that the musicians were taking it so seriously, playing it so well. I feel that I am bringing her dream to life. I mean, this is the kind of thing we really want, right? It's to really touch people and move people and feel like we're making a difference.
When you hit a musical vein as rich as Florence Price, you keep digging. Kahn has been playing Price's piano sonata for almost 2 years, and she's just finished developing a performance of Price's piano quintet, which she played last week with members of the New World Symphony in Florida. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Crimmins.
The Philadelphia Orchestra's performance of Florence Price's Concerto in One Movement will be available as a streamed concert through tomorrow.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business. Apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
One of the premier science fiction writers of the 20th century, Octavia Butler imagined worlds that were radically different and strikingly similar to the one we live in today.
For our Black History Month special series, The Cautionary Tales and the Reasons for Hope that Octavia Butler left us.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Grocery store workers across the country are stepping up their fight for hazard pay nearly a year now into the pandemic. Los Angeles County today announced it will provide an extra $5 an hour to grocery store workers, and other cities like Seattle and Long Beach, California have already passed similar measures. Some grocery store chains are pushing back by raising prices, cutting hours, or closing stores entirely. Let's bring in Robin Farzad. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, hi.
Good day, sir.
Good day to you. And we remember back in the spring that many grocery stores did have hazard pay for a few months, but now workers are saying they need it again because the pandemic is still going on. It sounds like some places are starting to listen. So how will these mandates help them?
Well, of course, the pay. For starters, $4 to $5 more per hour when you're talking about $11 to $12 an hour job. That's no small deal. And this on top of paid sick leave for quarantining and essentially overtime pay for coworkers who have to step up when others are out sick. So it would be a lot harder to lose your job if you have a fluidity of overtime and you don't fear retaliation for, say, seeing a doctor or taking a day or two off.
What's notable about many of these mandates is that they apply mostly, it sounds like, to stores that devote about 70% of their business to selling food. So that actually leaves out a fair amount of people, doesn't it?
Yeah, Walmart in particular stands out here. Though it's the king of all things brick-and-mortar retail, in many localities it is number one or number two when it comes to grocery. And it has bakeries, delis, and other very front-facing grocery functions. Walmart's food sales have been pressuring supermarkets, we know, for the longest time. And you're going to hear howls of protest that it's going to be especially painful for the likes of Kroger or Albertsons to have to jack prices or shutter stores or reduce hours when Walmart is exempt.
Yeah. Well, fair enough, because grocery store chains here are saying, to hear their side of the story, that they can't afford to provide hazard pay And so as a result, some have raised prices, some have closed stores because of this. Do they have a point? I mean, what is their financial situation right now?
This is and always has been a business of tiny profit margins. It's historically banked on high turnover, lower paid workers. And while sales for supermarkets have been great during the pandemic, cleaning and PPP related expenses, they've hit the bottom line. And ditto the fact that you can't count on salad bars and buffets and high margin services. And Amazon Whole Foods is hitting you with delivery. So overall, Peter, I think this is going to push out the rollout of self-checkout and more inducing people to shop from home, as kind of grocery stores say, we can't sustainably pay these people $15 an hour.
So pay is one issue. Vaccines, Robin, as you know, are another. I spoke a few weeks ago to a guy named Sam Dancy. He works at a grocery store in Seattle. He told me that he was still waiting for his shot. Let's listen.
Well, we're on the front line. You know, at one time we were considered heroes. I guess we're now zeros.
So, Robin, how many states have prioritized vaccines now for grocery store workers? Do we have any information about that?
Yeah, in D.C., for example, grocery workers are prioritized and eligible. There's much exasperation in Connecticut, where that's not the priority. As of a week ago, Peter, only 13 states are currently allowing grocery workers to sign up for vaccines. And most of the more than 2.5 million low-wage grocery workers in the U.S. have not yet been made eligible for the vaccine. So, like with so much else in the response to COVID, frustratingly, it is such a patchwork.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you so much.
If you are eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine and you've been trying to get one, you may have discovered that it is not easy. Vaccines are in very short supply right now, and making an appointment is tough.
Oh, I feel I'm totally in the dark. I know people around me are getting the vaccination, but I don't get it.
That's Mei Liu. She lives in Seattle and happens to be the mother of Deborah Wong, who is a journalist at KUOW Public Radio. Deborah joins us now to tell us their story. Welcome, and thanks for speaking with me about this.
Sure thing. Thank you.
So your mom is 91. She had a rough time trying to get an appointment for a vaccine. Tell me about her experience.
Yes. Well, she is a retired neuroscientist. She's super capable. She uses a computer and she doesn't like to ask for help. So she tried for a number of days to get an appointment for the vaccine. But eventually she just threw up her hands and said, forget it. It's not worth it. I'll just stay cooped up in my house until everyone else is vaccinated.
Well, we've certainly heard a lot of complaints from folks around the country, similar to your mom's. Remind us, Deborah, why it's been so complicated, so hard for so many people.
Well, in Washington state, and probably in many states around the country, we have a lot of different vaccine providers. There's more than 1,000, and they range from large hospital systems to neighborhood pharmacies to Costco's. And for the most part, they all have their own appointment systems. There's no centralized system. So you have to call or check each website individually. But because supply is so short, you're often met with a message that says, we have no vaccine, check back later. So you hear these stories of people who are just compulsively checking and checking to see if they can grab an open appointment.
Whenever they can. So how widespread is this problem then of people who are eligible, but having to jump through hoops just to find a vaccine?
I think it's pretty common. You do hear stories of people who have gotten appointments easily through their primary healthcare providers. And there are also local governments here that are focusing on getting vaccines to the most under-resourced communities. But that leaves a lot of other people who are on their own, and often they have to depend on family. And in that vacuum, a couple of fairly significant citizen efforts have popped up, and they've been spearheaded by people who have had their own negative experiences trying to navigate the system. People like Sharla.
It is survival of the fittest. It's who can type the fastest, who can click the fastest.
Now, Sharla doesn't want us to use her last name because ever since her effort went public, she and her brother Steve have gotten hate mail from anti-vaxxers. Sharla watched her in-laws try to get an appointment. It took 95 phone calls, she says. So she and her brother put their heads together to figure out how they could help. What they came up with was a Facebook group called Find a COVID Shot Wah, WA, W-A, Washington, and it's aimed at helping people who have limited resources, particularly communities of color, which have been hard hit by the virus.
Well, they sure have. I've seen this new study from Stanford University School of Medicine and Duke University School of Medicine that says more than half of all in-hospital deaths due to COVID-19 during the first 6 months of 2020 were among Black and Hispanic patients, which is just shocking. So, Deborah, what's the remedy here? How do we make scheduling appointments easier for people like your 91-year-old mom?
So the way it works on this Facebook group is, let's say someone is looking for a vaccine and they happen upon some open appointments. They then post that link on the Facebook page and they say to the community, hey, look, open appointments, go there now. Now, this group started just a couple of weeks ago, and they say they've connected thousands of people with appointments. Here's Sharla.
They've broken down in tears. They've been searching for 3 weeks for a vaccine and haven't got an appointment. And we get them an appointment in sometimes 5 minutes. And it's just the power of humanity, I feel like.
So that's an interesting low-tech solution, Deborah, just having a lot of eyeballs on the problem. You've also found some folks who are working on high-tech solutions. Tell us what those look like.
Well, there's this group of engineers and other tech folks, and they're trying to take all the work that people are now doing and automate it. Now, this is a guy named George Hu. He used to work for Microsoft, and he now teaches computer science. He says there's a simple solution that anyone who buys concert tickets is probably aware of.
What we need for this is those ticket scalpers. We need those bots to go and find me the appointments. The technology's out there, and so we just wanted to turn that technology for good for once.
Now, George mentors a student named Darren Lim, who's at MIT. And over a couple of days, Darren came up with a prototype of a program that would scrape data from a number of websites. And their own website went live on February 10th. It's called covidwa.com, and it's meant to be sort of one-stop shopping for appointments. So whenever a provider has new doses, it will appear on this site, and then people can click through to make the appointment. George Hu says it now covers 90% of the providers in the state, and they get tens of thousands of clicks every day.
Did it help your mom? Was your mom able to find an appointment after all this?
She was able to find her first shot, and now she's really happy to be waiting for her second.
Well, some difficult problems indeed, but some interesting solutions. Deborah Wong is a reporter for KUOW Public Radio in Seattle, Washington. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been reporting this week on this terrible pandemic milestone. More than 500,000 people have now died in the United States. And we continue our remembrance of those who lost their lives by listening to the music they loved and hearing their stories. The tribute is called Songs of Remembrance. And today we're hearing from Julie Seda of Chads Ford, Pennsylvania, remembering her former housekeeper and family friend, Janet Gonzalez, who died in Puerto Rico on December 31st.
Janet was from Santurce, Puerto Rico, and she was a natural caretaker and a very wise person. She was so fun to be around, and she made the best tostones, the best rice and beans, and she made it all seem very easy. My best memory of her was when we invited my mother to lunch. And she cooked for both of my parents, and she wanted to treat them like they were royalty. She was so incredibly warm to them just because they were my parents. And she didn't have a reason to be like that. You know, she could have just helped in whatever way she could and go home. But no, she wanted everybody to feel warm around her and feel well-fed and feel special around her. Also, I remember how she would talk about celebrities like she knew them personally. One of our biggest subjects was Marc Anthony and Jennifer Lopez. And we spent hours sometimes just chatting about how she was sure that they were a couple for a long time. And that always strikes me because you know how you have this kind of a friendship that never ends and you can talk to a person one day and talk to her years later and just strike conversations back. So with Janet, our conversations would turn back into funny things like that, but we just had fun about it. It was just a natural friendship. Janet loved Adios Le Pido by Juanes because it's a song that represents who she is, somebody who would trust God. So she'd be working around the house and she was, Adios Le Pido, mi reina. Adios Le Pido.
Que te quedes a mi lado y que más nunca te me vayas, mi vida.
Adios Le Pido.
Que mi alma no descanse cuando de amarte se trate, mi cielo.
Adios Le Pido.
In that song, you ask God and he hears you. And that was one of her biggest pieces of advice she always gave me. Don't question God and he will hear you. She just had this ability to connect with people. With her cheerful kind of person who would just mumble a song left and right every day as she constantly going into people's houses and doing work they don't want to do. So as we stroke a friendship, it started as just like, help me out with this. But I became part of her family. She chose me as part of her family. That's how I got to know her spirit. And that's how I got to know this amazing person. And I want to pay homage to how much she cared for us and for her children, Janira and Jan, to be proud of that. The fact that their mother touched many, many lives in her life in a very positive way.
You can see more of our tribute, NPR's Songs of Remembrance, at npr.org.
As a candidate, Joe Biden pledged to appoint a presidential commission to study possible reforms of the judiciary system. It is partly a reaction to what progressives saw as the rushed confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett just days before last year's election. But the nominating process is just one issue on which President Biden wants input from legal scholars.
I will ask them to come back to me with recommendations as to how to reform the court system, because it's getting out of whack.
That commission is now being formed by the White House counsel's office. David Freudberg from the public radio series Humankind has this report.
Various reform proposals have recently come to the fore among legal scholars. These include expanding the number of seats on the Supreme Court, which has been controversial in the past, but also setting term limits for justices who often serve into their 80s, and even changing the way Supreme Court cases are selected. And one idea seems to have special appeal for the Biden administration: diversify who sits on the federal bench. Kimberly Atkins, an attorney who has covered the Supreme Court, is a senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe.
The Supreme Court in recent history has become very coastal and very elite, right? Most of the justices were from either the East Coast or the West Coast. They were all former federal judges. They all went to elite schools. That hasn't always been the case.
A notable example is Earl Warren, one of the most influential chief justices in American history. He wrote the famous ruling Brown versus Board of Education, which outlawed racial segregation in public schools. When he was appointed by President Eisenhower in 1953, Warren had never before served as a judge, although he had been Attorney General of California and later governor.
The Constitution doesn't even require that a Supreme Court justice be a lawyer, let alone be a lawyer who went to Princeton and Yale. And the president can make an effort to seek out people with different backgrounds. I mean, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was a former legislator in Arizona. She was a politician before she was on the court, and that gives you a different perspective.
Federal judges represent a, quote, stunning lack of diversity, according to an analysis by the Center for American Progress. As of about a year ago, 80% of all sitting federal judges were white and 73% male. The U.S. population as a whole is 60% white, and slightly less than half of Americans are male. Professor Aaron Tang teaches law at the University of California, Davis.
There's an empathy gap in the federal judiciary right now. There's all sorts of social science research showing that, you know, we are predisposed for subconscious reasons as human beings to listen more closely to people who look like us, who have similar background experiences as us. And that's, I think, not a good thing when the judiciary is overwhelmingly white and male. And not just for sort of demographic, you know, visible demographic markers, but sort of background experience also, right? It's not a good thing that we've got all elite lawyers from elite law schools in that have stocked the federal courts.
There are some really excellent proposals afloat to diversify the professional backgrounds of judges in a way that could also create more racial and ethnic and socioeconomic diversity.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and a senior research fellow at Yale Law School.
We right now have a federal bench that tends to be skewed toward corporate law practice and prosecutors. If we had more judges who had been public defenders or civil rights lawyers, that could really make opportunities for people who just see the law differently. It could just open up the kind of lens of the judiciary. Encouraging people to come to the bench who have the kinds of jobs that sometimes appeal to people of color because they have a sort of socially relevant component to them.
This would require a shift in how jurists are recruited, not to downplay the importance of being deeply qualified to serve as a federal judge, but to broaden out the definition of who is genuinely qualified.
You would ask different people for their recommendations about who should go on the bench. Instead of going to the U.S. Attorney's Office and asking them to pick their ambitious prosecutors, you would also go to the federal public defender or state public defender's offices and ask them to name talented people. You would go to the biggest civil rights groups in the same way that now, the people who put together these lists in federal or state administrations usually go to the top corporate law firms. You would ask bar associations for people that have this kind of range of professional experience. I don't think it's actually very hard. You just have to will to do it.
The Biden administration recently informed the American Bar Association that the lawyers group would not have a role it has sometimes played in evaluating potential federal judges. Former President Trump had a similar policy with the association. The ABA represents nearly 200,000 American lawyers. During President Obama's tenure, most of the candidates rejected by the Bar Association were women or people of color. The ABA's president has said it is deeply committed to diversity and inclusion in the justice system. For Here and Now, I'm David Freudberg.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.